Hello, everyone. You might have seen a write-up of our book in LA Weekly. They said that Death by Umbrella, the 100 Weirdest Horror Movie Weapons, was rich with context and analysis, gruesome yet all in good fun. We're equal parts thrilled and humbled. Be sure to pick up a print or Kindle copy from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or Bear Manor Media. That's Bear as in the Revenant Bear, not naked. Anyway, on with the show.
News this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
I know what you're thinking. Mine's bigger than yours, right? Isn't that fair? Throw it away. All right? All right!
Tell me about Disneyland.
They got tons of popcorn there.
Yeah.
And all you gotta do is go climb a tree to go eat it.
It was a night like any other night. Then something happened.
Oh, good Lord. It's unbelievable. It's horrible.
Hey, wait. There's something weird here.
Welcome to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of low-budget cinema.
The sleep of reason gives birth to monsters.
Hi, my name's Chris, and along with Jeff, we're bringing you the very best and worst of horror, sci-fi, post-apocalyptic wasteland, kung fu, women in prison movies from the 1960s to today. Check us out at reallyawfulmovies.com, part of the Crypt TV family.
This summer, the legend of terror isn't just a campfire story anymore.
They say he smashed his way through the bunk room door, just a mass of flames. Cried out, I will return! I will have my revenge! He lives on whatever he can catch right now.
Summer 5 years ago is about to happen again and again and again. The Burning.
From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here's episode 127, 1981's The Burning. Well, we're heading over to upstate New York for this depiction of the Cropsey legend, which has come up in a recent documentary entitled, I think, Cropsey.
Yeah, yeah.
And so this thing was filmed in our backyard, Buffalo, New York, which we have a nice little connection to. And a great, great summer movie.
Just
and
a great,
fantastic summer camp movie.
Just a great standalone summer camp movie. I mean, when you look at the Friday series that came out 1 year prior, of course, this was made in the wake of that success. Interestingly enough, I mean, this movie, the script was written, this was one of the very first films ever released by Miramax. And the script was written by Bob Weinstein. Mm-hmm. He was one of the co-writers. And there were a lot of future stars in this movie, which we'll get to in a moment.
Yes.
But yes, as you said before, this was based on a much circulated urban legend in the upstate New York area, the Cropsey legend. And having gone to summer camp myself, these archetypes of evil, these boogeymen that they tell, that they regale the tales of around the campfire, they exist in every camp. They might not be named Cropsey, but they exist in every camp. In my camp, we had two, Alfie Taylor and Jungle Boy. I was scared shitless out of both of them. I think on the Our Sleepaway Camp podcast, I talked a bit about Jungle Boy. The legend of Jungle Boy was that on one night of the year, he would draw an X under your bed during the day. And, and if you came back to your cabin that night and saw an X under your bed, you wouldn't live to see the morning. Now, of course, the shit counselors I had, they knew that I was scared shitless of Alfie Taylor and Jungle Boy, and they put an X underneath my bed. So I spent that entire night with one eye open. You know, like I might have been clutching like a, I don't know, like a ping pong paddle or something for self-defense.
Well, what kind of counselors are they? Why did they stray so far from the man with the hook for a hand? Like, what is this a regional thing? Like, Alfie? Well,
that's the thing. Like, I don't know.
Alfie... Sounds like the drummer from, like, The Who or something. It's like Alfie Taylor or whatever, you know? But yeah. Like, who is, like, where do they get this from?
I don't know. And that's the whole thing. Like, where do these urban legends come from? In upstate New York, it was the Cropsey legend. And Cropsey represented an archetype of evil, a sort of boogeyman of sorts. Now, I did see the documentary Cropsey, and it was a very interesting documentary in the sense that they wanted to sort of study the roots of the Cropsey urban legend, figure out where this character came from, and their investigation led them to somebody by the name of Andre Rand, who they asserted was a real Cropsey.
And this guy was, what, institutionalized in a sanitarium or something? And actually, is it some mental case?
Right now, he's in prison at Rikers.
Ooh.
And he's in prison at Rikers for the kidnapping and possible death, because they haven't found the bodies, of 5 kids. But the thing is this. Andre Rand's first convicted killing took place in 1972. His last convicted killing took place in 1987. He was convicted in 88. The Cropsey legend starts circulating in Staten Island, Buffalo, what have you, as early as the 60s, well into the 70s.
Well, they might have just incorporated little bits of his, and these tales always get a little, you know, convoluted as the years go by, right? Who knows?
No, but what I'm saying to you is that, you know, the filmmaker of the Cropsey documentary, their assertion that Andre Rand is the Cropsey, it doesn't make sense, because the legend was already being told a good 12 years before he made his...
Yeah, and they hung their thesis on this in their whole film, so... Huh?
So I enjoyed the first half of the documentary, you know, how these urban legends started, how it spreads, but then when they start trying to pinpoint, like, the real Cropsey, then I thought it sort of fell apart. But nonetheless, in every camp, I guarantee you that there's an Alfie Taylor or a Cropsey.
Yeah, and it sends chills down your spine. You really are completely isolated from everything. And sitting around the campfire, you have your back to the other, the out there, that you can't... you know, put your head around, and you're just, you've got the circle of support that's right there, and as soon as you stray from it, like, you know how bloody hard it is if you don't have a flashlight and you go take a piss out in the bush, and you can get lost so easily, and it's just, it's frightening. That's the woods are scary.
That's what they made me do in the middle of the night, because they knew I was deathly afraid of Alfie Taylor working out in the woods. So, and
how does Alfie Taylor navigate the woods without a flashlight to murder and help his kids?
Well, here's what they made me do, okay? I was 10 years old. My sadistic counselor woke me up at, let's say, 2 in the morning and told me I had hemorrhoids. And he needed
me... He told you had hemorrhoids?
No, he had hemorrhoids.
Either one is no good.
And that's
so disturbing.
He made me go to the outhouse and get him toilet paper soaked in water to alleviate the pain of his hemorrhoids. I said, fuck no, I'm not going. Alfie Taylor's out there. He goes, no, you're going. You gotta go. You know, and this is a counselor that had slapped me already one time, so I had to go. I went out there, I'm like, okay, let me take a flashlight. Nope, no flashlights allowed. So I went my way to the outhouse, so, like, literally pissing my pants, shitting in my boots. And I took a bit of toilet paper, I soaked in the water, and ran back to my cabin. I gave it to him. He goes, no. Fuck, what the fuck is this? This is wrong. I only wanted half the toilet paper soaked. Go back. Did the same. He came back, said, now the water's too hot. Now the water's too cold. I had to go back and forth 5, 6, 7 times to get this guy the toilet paper for his supposed hemorrhoids. Meanwhile, he was fucking with me. This is probably the same guy that put the X underneath my bed. It was a nightmare. Is there any wonder I didn't go back to overnight camp next year? It was a fucking nightmare. Now, another thing is that you're talking about, the great unknown, the outdoors, and just like in The Burning, we had sort of like a camp away from camp, where you get in the canoe, and you go to an even more remote part of the camp, and that was called Intercamp. And that's where the real stories existed. Oh, the monsters existed in Intercamp. So, I mean, yes, watching The Burning, I mean, I could relate to so much of this. But it's such a wonderful movie. One thing I really love about this movie is it really felt real. I love the campers. They had such a camaraderie. They were just so... They were natural.
Yeah, you know? and yet also not camaraderie, because they're backbiting. As much fun as they're having, they're backstabbing one another in a way that the Friday kids really didn't. They're really at each other's throats in a lot of ways, too. Like, you have this power struggle between, you know, this Woody Allen nerd there, this, what is it, Alfred. And he's getting his arse beat by these various guys who have an in for him because he's a weirdo, and then you have this sexual dynamic with Glazer, and they have stuff that, it's not all fun and games. Well, like, there is stuff that's happening. It's like real life.
Really, the only antagonist was Glazer. I mean, everybody else was pretty nice and had the Kemper's best interest at heart. I mean, Glazer was the one that was tormenting Alfred. Glazer was the one that was trying to mack on a very young-looking Kemper. Glazer kind of reminded me of like a roided-up Spicoli. Mm-hmm. You know, from Fast Times at Ridgemont High, Sean Penn's character. Glazer had, he had people at his back. He had Woodstock, played by Fisher Stevens, future husband of Michelle Pfeiffer, also future star of the Short Circuit movies. He had George Costanza's character, Jason Alexander, what was the name of his character again?
David something or other, who just kept changing his outfits to a different number 69 shirt. I don't know why I noticed that. But
The resident horn dog and procure prophylactic.
Yes.
So Woodstock and Jason Alexander's character would rally around Alfred and help him against the nefarious Glazer. So I just thought, I mean, like I said, like in the interaction with the Kempers, just as they're playing their baseball games and they're on the pier and so on, it just seemed like
it was really fleshed out. Yeah. Whichever Weinstein brother co-wrote this, they really gave all these people, it's a cliche that you really got to know them, but you really do, in a way. The victims of Jason are pretty much interchangeable, forgettable nobodies, with the exception of the guy in the wheelchair. But these guys, all, you were, you know, again, a cliche, you're all rooting for them. They're all great characters. Even Glazer, like every Kemp has a Glazer.
Exactly. So, and even Glazer showed a little bit of vulnerability, so that by the time he got off, you were kind of, oh man, now I'm starting to like Glazer.
Yeah.
Holly Hunter was in this movie.
Yes.
He played a camper named Sophie. So, I mean, the pedigree is incredible. You have the Weinsteins, you've got Jason Alexander, you've got Fisher Stevens, you've got Holly Hunter, and you've got an incredible story to hang your
hat on.
That would be the Cropsey legend.
And a wonderful prologue in true 80s horror movie style, where you have Camp Blackfoot, since shut down, and a bunch of campers who are plotting to get revenge on this, I guess, sadistic caretaker of their camp, who is the Cropsey in question.
Yeah, I mean, they don't really say what he did. All they say is that he's an alcoholic, he's a drunk, and he's a tormentor. They hate him, so they want to get even with Cropsey. So, one night while Cropsey's sleeping it off, they go into his cabin and they take this worm-infested skull and they put candles.
Yeah, that wasn't really explained well how they got this all together, but yeah, that was neat, yeah.
And they put candles in its eyes, and then they went outside, they banged on the window, and Cropsey wakes up and he sees the candle and he freaks out. And he knocks it over, and before you know it, the entire cabin's up in flames. Man on fire, I love Man on Fire. Cropsey runs out, he's all immolated, you know.
Yeah, barely clinging to life, and, you know, recuperating at the local hospital.
St. Catherine's Hospital.
Yeah, a terrific set piece where you have this black orderly who's trying to get, like, is it a doctor? Yeah. Like, the guy has got, he seems completely phazed by the job. Mm-hmm. So he brings him in, come on, man, you gotta see this. Brings him into the room.
Oh, my favorite line, he goes, oh, no, you gotta see, man. This guy is burnt so bad, he's cooked. He's a fucking Big Mac overdone. You ain't never seen a freak like this one.
Yeah.
And then when the doctor sees Cropsey, he just runs.
He's supposed to be an ER doctor? Yeah. He's certainly not a dermatologist. Who knows what he is, but he's not cut out for the job. He's done for.
Yeah.
And Cropsey emerges kind of a sad, you know, what kind of figure? A sympathetic figure. He comes out and he's doomed to seek companionship from ladies of the evening.
Was it companionship or was it revenge? I mean, that's the thing. Because, you know, then they do the sort of the jump 5 years later, and as they're wheeling Cropsey out, and of course we don't see what Cropsey looks like, and they say, okay, Cropsey, you're now fit to return to society. Unfortunately, the skin grafts didn't take. We did what we could. Cropsey, you've got to get rid of your anger. You've got to get rid of
your determination.
You got to let it go. And then the next thing we know, we see Cropsey walking down the main streets of some city, and he picks up some floozy, some lady of the evening, and he's dressed like a giallo killer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and a black trench coat and a black hat. So we don't see his face. And he takes this girl up to his room, and my contention was he wanted to kill her right from the get-go.
Yeah, or he was just so set off by her reaction to his freakishness that it made him angry. Either way, yeah, maybe he's just practicing for the campers, getting his few kills under his belt in the big city before heading out to the bucolic wilderness. Who knows? Either way, it was pretty fucking scary.
Either way, it was an incredibly gory kill. Great set piece, of course, the master Tom Savini behind it.
And oh, yeah, and the way they set off, like giallo style, where they show the gleaming shears, and then you know, like, she's going to get it via this implement, which we wrote about in our book.
This was amazing. They made it into our book. Indeed. Mm-hmm. Yep. Well, I might as well spoil it. It's a pair of garden shears. Yep. And that's Cropsey's weapon of choice. So after that, we now establish our bad guy. And, you know, it's funny because you say, like, there is some sympathy towards Cropsey because we really don't know, you know, what he did to these camps. It almost seems that the punishment was more severe than the crime. Because whatever Cropsey did, you know, we see Cropsey before he got burned. He just looked like a not exactly attractive guy. Mm-hmm. I don't know what. I mean, I've been to camp, as I said earlier in this podcast. There were caretakers that we would terrorize too. And we'd say, oh, that hated care. We're going to get him. And he did nothing. It was some old, weak guy, that us shitty little 10 and 12 year olds would terrorize. So for all we know, Cropsey did nothing. But he was turned into a Big Mac. So now he wants revenge. And now we are brought to a new camp, a different camp. This would be Camp Stonewater. And this is where our intrepid campers, Dave, Alfred, Karen and Eddie, Sally, this is where they're there to have a wonderful summer.
Yeah, and this is where the age and sexual dynamics really got to me, because you see, you're introduced to them playing this rousing game of baseball, and you see, like, there's people of different ages. Like, one, his name is Tiger, like a girl, and in the mess hall, you see a bunch of kids as well. So I was confused as to how many of these people were campers and how many were counselors.
I know,
like,
me too.
I was expecting to see, let's say, Jason Alexander, this character, wearing like an orange staff or blue staff shirt to indicate they're a counselor. But there seems to be nobody in a position of authority other than Todd and the guy who runs the whole camp. But there's really, like, the ratio of campers to authority figures is so high. Mm. If I were a parent, I would never let my kids go to this camp. Like, it's a wonder none of them just drown or die. There's no one there.
I thought too at first that David, Jason Alexander, and Glazer were counselors. They look so much older.
Yeah, they look at least 26.
Yeah, then some of these other campers look so young. I mean, Sally, the one that Glazer has his amorous eye on, we see her taking a shower before she's spooked by Alfred, and we see her.
We see her puffy nipples.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, look, to me, she looked all of 12.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it almost looked a bit wrong. So you're right. I mean, there really was a weird sort of age dynamic in this camp. I mean, we saw a lot of young kids in the background, like, but the protagonist campers, with the exception of Woodstock, who looks sort of young.
Yeah, he bridged the gap between the two groups, but none of the kids were preyed upon. They were just background filler for the mess hall.
Yeah.
Very weird.
Now we've got to talk about David, about Jason Alexander's character. I mean, he was hilarious. You know, he had a full head of hair.
Yeah.
That's one thing. But other than that, he was more or less Costanza through and through. This is Jason Alexander. But, I mean, you know, he was the one. He was a man who would go out there and he would, you know, get the prophylactics for Glazer to hopefully use with Sally.
Get the Hustler and the girly magazines for the, you know, from the local post office or whatever, and just procure all the vice-related materials for all these people to beat off to or whatever else.
And he would not stop talking in sexual innuendo. I mean, as they're canoeing in the boat, he goes, "I told you not to beat your schlong last night. It degrades your power, you know?"
Yeah.
So it's like absolutely hilarious. Absolutely hilarious. And you could tell right then and there that this kid, or maybe like guy in his early 20s, blank, and it's going to be somebody, because he looked really... You can just tell. I mean, there was something about him. You know, there's definitely a star quality right back in 1981. You know, this is a camp movie, and you're going to have the camp conventions. And we got to say, this came out 1 year after the first Friday the 13th. And as you said earlier, before we started recording, in your opinion, this out Friday.
Mm-hmm.
And I totally agree with you. This is way better, in my opinion, than the first Friday the 13th.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think it was the guy at FearNet or some critic said, oh, it's really slow-moving and dull, but I would argue that it's more of an investment in the background people than it is just a nameless psychopath roaming the woods. Like, we get only brief snippets of Cropsey skulking about in the woods and killing, we get most of the tension set up here with all the people, and that's really what should drive a horror movie.
Yeah,
it's
for sure,
interpersonal dynamics, and which this has in spades. So.
When they take the camping trip to go out to the camp where they eventually a lot of them get slaughtered, you know, that's what we now really feel for these kids, because we've grown to like them.
Yeah.
And, of course, we have to have, you know, the de rigueur campfire where they're around, you know, telling the tale about Cropsey, and then somebody's got to jump in wearing a mask and spook all the kids. Yeah. And, of course, that was then ripped off wholesale for the Friday 13th sequel, Friday 13th Part 2, when they were counting the tale of Jason, and then the prankster jumped into the campfire and did the same. And so they're out there. And so now we sort of have our main characters sectioned off. You know, they're away from all the young campers back at the main camp. And they realize that their canoes are missing. What to do?
Well, yeah, what to do? You're in the middle of nowhere. I did one of these camping trips as well, because at least when you're at summer camp, you have the outhouse. When you do one of these day trips and side trips, and these people were out for 3 days, there are no bathrooms to speak of. So I did one of these canoe trips where you portage, where you carry your canoe on your shoulder and you go out into the wilderness, and I held in number two. I did not poop for an entire week out in this northern Ontario bush, and then when I got home, it was just brutal. I was just so just plugged up. I could not take it. I'm not shitting in the bush. I did not want to be walked in on by someone with my ass sticking in, like, God knows what, poison ivy or what. I held it in. It was so awful. I was in pain toward the end.
Yeah. Wonderful story, but I have to do the kids canoes getting...
Well, no, but it's when you separate a bunch of people out. Mm-hmm. Like, this is their only means of getting anywhere close mm-hmm. to civilization. As one character says, like, we cannot just hike back, because mm-hmm. there's miles, maybe hundreds of miles of just bush, because this is upstate New York. There's nothing around mm-hmm. there. They need their canoes or they're doomed, yeah. essentially.
Now, we should mention, too, before they find that their canoes are missing, Karen and Eddie, they're two campers who have this weird sort of love-hate thing going.
Yeah, weird sexual dynamic. He's a Brooklyn meathead. He's sort of this Italian smooth Lothario. He's trying to mack on her and eventually gets her out to some swimming hole and gets her to... This is really weird sexual politics as well. She just completely gets naked.
Naked as a jaybird.
Naked as a jaybird, jumps into the water with mm-hmm. him, and they proceed to make out, and then mm-hmm. she rebuffs him.
Yeah.
And you think, geez, that's bad luck on his part. You get a girl naked, and he can't close the deal. Like, she pushes him away.
Can you say blue balls?
Yes. Yeah, it was crazy. And to her peril, because she has to get out. And speaking of stealing things...
Her clothes.
Mm-hmm. So we got missing canoes, and her undergarments are strewn about the woods, and this was a pretty neat scene where she's going around trying to find her underwear and her bra and everything, and it's become twilight, and she's trying to find her stuff. She mm-hmm. thinks she's been pranked, obviously, mm-hmm. as this happens all the time, and when she gets it, that is something else.
That was another great set piece.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, I mean, the kills in this film are just virtuoso. The best is yet to come, of course, on the mm-hmm. raft, but we'll get mm-hmm. to that soon. So now we have the missing canoes, and we also have missing Karen. They have to figure out, what are we going to do? I mean, maybe the canoes were set adrift somehow overnight. So they put together this rickety assemblage of logs, this raft.
Look pretty good.
Well, yeah, I guess so.
Yeah, they're prepared. They got their Boy Scout badges. Yeah. But this thing is incredible, and they seemingly build it out of... I mean, structurally, it looks incredible, and their paddles are really incredibly well constructed. Mm-hmm. And they did this in, what, a day? It was just the lead guy who happened to put it all together, and they're trying to go get help. Mm-hmm. And the thing is seaworthy, or whatever, fresh lake worthy. They push it out, and holy crap. They have six of them going, everything's fine and dandy, they're paddling, they spot the canoe in the distance,
canoes,
and this was really cool, when they drift up to it.
One of the best scenes. I mean, and you know, as they're drifting up to it, and they're happy, and they're cheerful, they see the canoe, they're...
They realize they can get back to camp and
kind of
take a shit.
They're kind of joking around each other, you know, about... Yeah, exactly, but and then, I mean, like I said before, this scene is one of the best scenes in
horror history?
At least in the slasher subgenre, if not horror history, where... Suddenly, who pops out of the canoe but Cropsey, branching those garden shears, and an incredible silhouette. And then, oh my god, we gotta call it, like, Not the burning, but the snipping.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, he snips three of Woodstock's fingers off. Stabs another girl in the throat. The blood gurgles out of her neck. It's a fucking massacre. It's unbelievable. And, like, as we said before, because we're so invested in these characters, you really do feel something.
And how did he manage to pull off this carnage, too? He's on this rickety raft, but he's stabbing them with aplomb and snipping their digits and doing all this stuff. It's just an incredible scene. And we'd be remiss without mentioning, what I liked about this is the lack of music. As great as the music was, mm-hmm. and we'll talk about, like, Rick Wakeman, the shitty rock band,
Yes.
and he's a keyboard player, but the music was minimalist. When it happened, it was amazing, but the fact is, most of the movie was silent, and that really charges up the atmosphere when you're just, all you're hearing is rustling leaves and insects and the bush. Another actor in this ensemble piece was the woods. Mm-hmm. It was amazing.
Yep.
And when they drift toward that canoe, everything is just deathly silent. And he's just perched there, ready to pounce. And I did not see that one coming. And who knew that's what would happen? I just figured they would get to land, go their separate ways, and be picked off individually, a la Jason Voorhees, and that would be it. But
you didn't expect that massacre.
Whoa, what a massacre.
I don't think audiences in 81 expect that either, you know, especially like kids as young as this. And yeah, I mean, it was brutal. It was brutal. As I said before, you had slashed across the forehead, you had fingers being snipped off, you had, you know, shears within throats, blood gurgling. It was absolutely brutal. And then, you know, Cropsey's now on his rampage, and he's now trying to pick off all the rest of the campers. Glazer gets it. He even almost gets Todd. Then they realize, okay, well, fuck, man, somebody's after us. And they go back to camp, and they try and marshal their forces against Cropsey. And it's just incredible.
Oh, another great scene, because we could just talk endlessly about all these scenes, was, I forget the authority figure, I guess the guy who ran the camp, not Todd's boss.
Right.
They rush up the stairs to this log cabin and say, like, there's been a murder, and he figures he's being pranked because this is summer camp. Sure, yeah, whatever. The girl, I forget who it was, says to him, just look at the kids. And he looks over at the lake, and there's a dock where they've canoed to.
These are the lone...
The survivors.
Survivors.
And they are shaking.
Yes.
And they're just completely traumatized, a la kids who've escaped Columbine or something. They look realistically really buggered up. And that was a great scene, too, because, yeah, again, she begs him to get, like, an outboard and say, we got to get out of here because there's a killer on the loose. And this was just great, because you don't see this in other sadistic killer in the woods movies. They really had to figure out what to do and how to proceed.
It had all the elements that you had seen your Fridays, you had seen your sleepaway camps, but at the same time, you had the formula, but they did something different with it. You know, they made it more realistic. They made it more... there was more verisimilitude, I guess. There was more sympathy for the impending victims. It was just, there was something about it that just made the burning just feel so much more horrific. And speaking of horrific, I mean, when we finally see the visage of Cropsey, wow.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, wow. Great, great, great makeup. I don't know how many times in this podcast that we've expounded the genius of Tom Savini, but this man is just absolutely incredible. Between the kills and the burnt face of Cropsey, just brilliant.
Some of his finest work, yeah.
Yeah, well, we say that with every other prowler. His finest work, you know? I mean, everything he does is fucking brilliant.
Yeah.
And then,
well, in the Prowler, he more saved the Prowler, whereas here there was more of a cohesive film built around it, around this killer. So, yeah, his stuff was an adjunct to an already good movie, whereas the Prowler, kind of a dim-witted film and...
With great effects. And then the denouement with Cropsey versus Todd.
A little bit of a letdown because they just went into some weird structure. What was that? Some abandoned mine or what the hell was that? They were wandering around this building and Cropsey's there with his
blowtorch
to try and immolate Todd. And it turns out, I guess, should we spoil it? It doesn't matter at this point, right?
Yeah, I guess, yeah.
Who's implicated. Implicated in the original Camp Blackfoot. So mano-a-mano tilt, you know, and then I don't know if this was supposed to introduce some sympathy for Cropsey at this point. It really wouldn't, because he's already offed half these campers, and what happens, happens, right? Todd versus Cropsey.
Right, and You said you were going to spoil it, so you might as well
spoil it.
Well, it gets burned again. And on fire. It's awesome.
Burn.
And that's what I love about it, too, because as I said earlier, it's a great standalone movie. There was not, you know, The Burning 2. There was not, Burn Harder, Burn Hotter, you know? Burn Faster, Burn, I don't know, whatever. That was it. Cropsey's dead. Those that are left alive have to pick up their lives and deal with this trauma, and that was the end of that. Awesome. Loved it. Just crackerjack filmmaking, a wonderful slasher.
And an amazing trailer, too. The trailer is just dynamite. The music is superlative. His day job may be crappy as a keyboardist, and yes, with these ludicrous giant keyboards and the shitty prog rock that he makes, but holy crap. That
weird, like, Moo-Moo-esque sparkly blossom he wears on stage. Yeah. Right?
Dressed like a wizard on stage, as was the style during 1970s progressive rock. But Rick Wakeman brought the goods to this incredible, like, minimalist and yet highly evocative score. Like, I can't say enough about this. It was just, it made me happy because it conjured up the good feelings about summer camp that I had, obviously pre-murdering and everything. But in the Friday podcast, we talked about our negative...
You mean summer camp movies, slashers?
Summer camp generally, before the murders happened, because in the last podcast about Friday the 13th, we talked about our negative experiences with summer camp. This was joyous and fun, and it reminded me of canoeing up in northern Ontario. They're all racing one another, and someone invariably tips their canoe, and they're just laughing, and just they're there for the whole summer. They're, you know, macking on one another. They're trying to get laid, which I was always in the camp that was, no pun intended, not getting laid. So there's one of these guys who's like lusting after the hot counselor, and you could never get them, and you're just sort of sexually frustrated and trying to make the best of it with your friends. It was a fun experience. And again, you know, before everything went to shit with Cropsey hunting them, but it was a joyous depiction of that rite of passage for kids in upstate New York and Ontario as well. It was just a glorious movie.
And another kind of interesting little factoid about The Burning is that there was another film, another camp slasher, that was in production at the exact same time as The Burning. And it, too, was going to be based around the Cropsey legend. This is the film that ultimately became Madman, with another great killer, Madman Mars. Now, Madman is not as renowned as The Burning or Friday the 13th, but it's a fun film. But when word got out to the producers of Madman,
Don Draper, whatever.
A Madman that this film, The Burning, was being made, and they realized, okay, we have to now, you know, sort of stray away from the Cropsey legend and do something different. Which is kind of funny because in a lot of ways, horror is known for, you know, taking something and just running with it. Okay, they're doing Cropsey, we'll do Cropsey too, but they decided to do something a little bit different, and we got Madman Mars and Madman, and we got Cropsey in The Burning. So, as you said before, a great depiction of the fun, joyous camaraderie of summer camp, but at the same time, an incredible slasher with a really, really cool villain who maybe could have been fleshed out a little bit more. We could have known a little bit more of his backstory. We could have known what he did that was so terrible that these kids felt that they had to.
And also maybe how he prepared his kills, because apart from the POV that you get of him leering in the woods, you really don't see what he does in the same way you would with Jason. So he gets, like, he's just more of a foot, and then the shears come out, and then the kill, which is not necessarily a problem, but, interesting pacing to this thing, because it's very slow, but then when the kills come, it's hardcore, action-packed, and then it goes back to its laconic pace, and then just it just really sets off the kills in a way that other movies don't, because you become inured or indifferent to the kills in Friday. This one kill after another after another, this one kill, and then you're like, holy shit, and then back to hunky-dory fun campground games. And so it's just amazing.
I didn't find it slow at all. I mean, I really, maybe because of this, myself,
not
feeling,
slow in a negative way, but I liked that it countered the kills with the fun in a way that, you know, I wasn't bored by any means. It was joyous, I thought.
So what did you learn from The Burning?
I learned that if you're going to pull a prank on someone, you apparently can pull together this with four of your Larrikin idiot buddies, you can put together this like Fulci skull with worms coming out of it that's burning and you know, with no regard to the guy's personal safety, and put this and kill the guy in his cabin.
All they wanted to do was like, scarecrow. See, they didn't want to immolate.
But couldn't they have? No, but this whole to do with the skull, couldn't they have just dunked a bottle of, or a pail of water on his head, or like made him, you know, like put a, like, who knows what they could have done to him? Like, there's so many pranks he could do, right? Like when he's sleeping, you put his hand in a warm bucket, and then he pisses himself, right? That's the time-honored camp, you know, like a stunt.
They could have put a flaming bag of poop outside.
Yeah, yeah, of all the things to do, like, and it's so elaborate, like the Fulci skull. Where they got this from, it was not explained. Did they make it out of wax? It was really weird. Anyway, what did you learn?
I'm just thinking about, like, you know, dunking a bottle of water. That would have made for a very interesting film.
Yeah, or a rope?
He's angry, he's wet, and he's out for revenge. Just sloshing.
What is it? Is it a road apple? Where you, is that the term for like a bag of, where you bag dog shit and set it on fire and chuck it?
Well, I don't know. That's what I meant. Oh, you chuck it. Instead of like
okay, well, whatever. Like, I don't know. There's many things that we could have done to prank this poor, lonely, drunk caretaker that did not include a fire hazard. But anyway, yeah. What did we learn?
Well, yeah, and I also learned that whatever Podunkshank Cropsey was living in was certainly not flame retardant in any way whatsoever. Because the minute he knocks over that skull, I mean, that place just went up like a tinderbox.
Yeah, you know? Well, maybe his clothing was doused in booze or who knows what.
You know
what?
That could have been it. I mean, they did say at one point, when they were counting the Cropsey legend, that he could strip the paint off the walls with his breath because he was so drunk. But yeah, just a really fun movie.
Yeah, amazing.
And, star rating?
I'm going to give this a 4. It really stands out amongst its slasher brethren because of the depth of feelings and terrific performances. And it's just full of heart and amazing kills and a great summer camp urban legend to base it on. Amazing. It really, when you look at all the other films that came out around that time, none of which is really as memorable, with the exception of maybe Sleepaway Camp for its wild denouement that still stands up. But the rest of the movie didn't stand up as well as this. 4 for me. What about you?
Yeah, I'll give it 4 stars, for sure.
Nice.
Yeah. No, it's one of my favorites, I gotta say. I really like The Burning.
And surprisingly, it hasn't been remade.
Well, you know what? Let's not remake it.
Oh, yeah?
It's interesting because there really hasn't been a bona fide mainstream slasher that's been released to cinemas since, I think, the Scream movies. You know? I mean, can you think of the last slasher that had a wide cinematic release? I mean, there's been slashers in the indie world, but
maybe The Hollow or The Hollow? What's the one with the noose? Oh, I never saw it.
Oh, The Gallows?
Oh, The Gallows. Yeah. Okay, well, my bad. The Hollows. What the hell? Some Down in the Holler? Yeah.
Found footage bullshit. No, I mean, that's the thing.
That was found footage more so than... Okay. I can't think of anything.
I really think that the heyday of the slasher is done. If they do make... I mean, they are talking about making... Of course, we talked about this with Scott Drebbit. Halloween. There's another Fry that might be coming out, but I'd like to see something new, you know? A new slasher icon for the new millennium. That would be something. So instead of remaking The Burning, let's get something new. I would like to see that.
For sure. Maybe something to do with law enforcement, a la Maniac Cop, where you have that interesting dynamic of someone who's supposed to enforce the law, who basically can do whatever he pleases under the guise of the badge. That's a really interesting conceit, but... Mm-hmm. Who knows? You can do stuff with... A lot of the stuff with social media has been utter crap, so that's probably not a good way to do, but I agree. Like, there's a world of possibilities out there to reboot the slasher, and time will tell. I would love to see it return.
For sure.
And for more, check out our website where we review films 3 times a week, and of course, tune into our podcast every week. New episodes uploaded Friday, and we'll talk to you soon.
Take care.